Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrer, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today's guests need no introduction. You're both recurring popular guests. So I'm joined by Shel Breton and Claire Mullet. Yeah, welcome back.
Thank you.
Shel, is it third time for both of you?
I think.
Oh my gosh, it is. Yes.
Somewhere around that. And we're talking a little collaboration that you're doing together, which is fun, which I never expected to see it, and I knew nothing of it. And then Claire, you posted that you were with Shell in Norway, and I was like, what's happening, what's going on here?
It's like I guess my mum calls that swapping hats. Like, it's okay. Not the hat you expect to see someone wearing in a certain mm-hmm. circumstance. I think that's a pretty good way of describing it, maybe. But
yeah, it definitely took me by surprise, but that's always the most fun things. Fun things do.
Yeah.
So where should we start? Oh, actually, no. We'll start with my day. Because I feel like we can get that out of the way first. Because as I told you earlier, I did like a Polish radio interview type thing. Which mm-hmm. was 2 hours long. It was very long. And it was, I enjoyed it. It wasn't something I expected that I would do. And we were just talking about mythology and history. And a part of something came up that made me a little bit sad, I guess. That they asked, the lady asked about if my favorite English folk tale. And I stuttered. Because I was like, shit, I don't really know any English folk tales. And then I was like, okay, well, what do we have?
And we don't have that many.
No, and I quickly pulled up Google and was like, shit, what do I? And then we had like King Arthur, Robin Hood, Springheel Jack, some kind of really obscured ones. And then there was the Herne the Hunter, which I'd never heard of before, and it got me thinking as to why we don't really have, because we have such a history, we have a very long, vast history as a country, but where do you think our folk tales have gone, or what's happened there, Claire? What do you think?
Well, to give a sort of very half-hashed guess, I have heard this talked about before, but not. You know, it's been a while since I discussed it, but apparently the certain pattern of invasions and mix-ups we have had as a nation has contributed to this upheaval. I mm-hmm. think that we probably used to have more, but there's been, you know, we, particularly the Norman conquest, I think, was responsible for a lot of stuff going out of the window, okay. because we had so much brought over from Central Europe and brought into the status quo of the literary canon and storytelling, chanson de geste, and, you know, the tales of courtly endeavor. And those aren't really folk tales as such. I mean, I think there is more folklore than specific stories. Mm-hmm. But one story I think one of the oldest tales we have, as far as I recall it, is Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yes, yeah.
And that's probably, if you can count an English folk tale or one that's relatively close to being something we can say is an old English story, I think that's possibly my favourite.
Mm-hmm. I was saying that most of these stories that I know of weren't passed down through any type of folk tradition. It was, I saw the Robin Hood movie. I read the Roald Dahl book. I feel like we just unless it was just me and my family, we just didn't have like this tradition of folk stories. And it got me quite sad. I was like, oh, why don't we have that anymore?
Yeah, to be fair, I think a lot of countries, I think that is folklore still. Now, I don't know, Shell, you may have your opinion on this, but one of the things I've been studying at the minute is how far is it fair to put a distance between different kinds of transmissions? Is it still folklore if you see the story through a movie, or if you see it through a book? It doesn't have to be your granddad telling you by the fireside.
That's what I want.
Yeah, I know that's what you want. That'd be fun. Mm-hmm. But this is what I used to enjoy about my library job, because to some extent I wasn't exactly telling folklore every day, but bringing back the idea of just listening and absorbing and not putting any kids on the spot who weren't particularly comfortable reading out loud. Mm-hmm. It was a really great exercise to do. And I think there should be more of it for adults as well. I think we definitely need more storytelling.
Yeah, it would be nice. But I was also thinking when I was talking earlier how we're never bored. You know, we've all got this little magic device in our hands that you can ring someone up on, or you can watch an infinite number of videos on Instagram or YouTube, and or put Netflix on. We don't get bored. And I only remember as a kid ever like being really sat with my family when we had a power outage. And we had to light the candles, and then we were like, "Oh, now we're going to have to play a game and talk to each other." And it's quite sad as an adult to think back. That's the only time we really sat together and when we were absolutely forced, and there was nothing else because there was darkness everywhere else, and it was like, "Yeah, we all have to sit in this one room now."
Okay, kind of have the same kind of memory, even though my mom did read stories to me when I was little, but I also see that because. I have this other project called Vibe Mugella, which what we're doing is that we have a performance that we do in schools in Norway. It's an official program that artists go to school, so they teach children about things through music and storytelling. And my experience is that the kids absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, of course, they see a lot of games, they see a lot of movies and stuff, but they love when somebody actually comes there and they can see me play my flute and they can see the ladies yoiking and telling the story, you know. Mm-hmm. They really like it. And as you say, it should be more of it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where my love of history came from. I had a very good history teacher, Mr. Ainley. If you're listening, I don't know. I don't think you will be, but if you are, then he was my history teacher for year 9, 10, and 11. So what would that be, Claire? Is that like 14 to 16, maybe?
Yeah, 14 to 16, essentially. Somewhere around
that, yeah. And he was just a brilliant storyteller. Like, there was very little learning out of textbooks. He would stand at the front of the class and he would tell these amazing stories about history, and it just engulfed me into it, and I just fell in love with history ever since, and went with it. And then I studied history at college, and the teacher wasn't like that, and he just gave me a textbook, and I was like, I don't like this anymore. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, there's a reason storytelling works. I unfortunately had your college experience at the age you had, Mr. Ainley, or Ainley, what did you say he was called?
Mr. Ainley.
I'm not going to say her name on it. I doubt she will be listening, but nevertheless, I'm still not going to say her name on it.
She might be.
The most boring history teacher ever for about 4 years. And I'm not saying she didn't kill history, because that's impossible, but she certainly put me off studying it for quite a long time. I mean, the nice thing was we didn't do any ancient history with her. We did ancient history with our Latin teacher, who was a real amazing teacher, much like your guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think that's perhaps what led me towards the medieval, because just ancient's always been the interesting one. And our teacher for the modern period, I mean, we basically did lift stuff out of the textbook. And it was all the period. I mean, we must have done the Second World War twice at least, stock market crashes. It was all money stuff and very, very recent bombs and delegations and treaties. And while it's obviously important, storytelling is needed. Mm-hmm. It was really uninspiring.
Yeah, it's not as fun for a kid.
Mm. And when people ask me, why did you take Latin A-level? It wasn't as stupid as it sounded. It was because it was so interesting. And because our teacher was a storyteller.
Mm-hmm. It is that though, like your teachers can form the path you take in life. They're very important because if you have a good teacher in a certain subject, then usually, you know, you're going to lean towards that because it's something that you enjoy, rather than maybe you have a subject that you're quite good at. But if your teacher's not very good or not engaging, then you just kind of shut off, I guess, and don't enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, had it not been for my last year of sixth form English teacher, I think I wouldn't have studied English at university either. I was fairly sure that was what I wanted. But again, same situation as with the history teacher, same teacher for 4 years. I don't think she really liked the subject. But then we had a doubling up of teachers in the final year, and this crazy, amazing Glaswegian lady called Marjorie McGee came along and just sort of
What a name that is.
She was amazing. And she brought it to life again. And that made me, it's when you realize, oh, wait, yes, there is a reason I like this. I'm not by myself. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Yeah. Otherwise, I think I would have studied French and wouldn't have been here now. So, yeah. So it's astonishing what that can do, I guess.
Yeah. Absolutely. And hopefully, Shell, that's kind of the effect you have on children in a much smaller window, because obviously you're not getting to see them through a full year. But when you're doing these projects in schools, you must be leaving. They must go home and be so excited, because I bet they go home and tell their parents, like, I saw a real Viking today.
Yeah, like, well, we're not Vikings. We were teaching about Sami culture, but we have a real Sami person that is actually a Sami now. Mm-hmm. That comes with her beautiful dress and tells from her life. And then we tell a story. It's a tale, a really beautiful tale about the daughter of the sun that teaches the Sami people to tame their deers. And and then Marit comes in and tells a little bit from her life, how she learned to yoik and how the drum came to her. And, you know, it's a really nice story. And the children absolutely seems to love it. And so did the teachers. So at the moment, we were expanding, which is good. Yeah.
No, I bet they do have that memory when they go home. And it probably will stick with them. Some of them, it will stick with them for a lifetime. It'll be this experience that they don't always get. And it'll just... Yeah, it'll be there, and it is nice. It has these how you shape children for the future.
I have this, if I may, I have this really nice story that I was because you know I've been telling stories about ancient instruments for decades now, and I was playing at the opening of this new museum up at the coast of Norway here. They built this really gigantic Viking ship and. It's so big that they actually built the museum around it, you know. So, and I was up there, and they were opening, and there was this young lady singing, and she appeared to be like the winner of the Norwegian music contest for young people, and blah blah blah. And she came to me after I was doing my story time before she was going on to do her show, and she was like, you know, you remember me? And I said, yeah, I can remember your face, but I can't really place it. And she told me that, yeah, you know, many years ago, you were up here and you did one of your Viking music storytelling things. And you sat down with me for 2 hours after that and taught me how to play your instruments. And that's why I'm doing this.
Oh, see, and that's, I mean,
yeah, that's wow. You know,
that's beautiful.
Yeah. But again, that's a testament to the beautiful person that you are, Shell, and that you have these moments where you spend the time with this young girl and taught her how to play it. And it's probably the same way that you've ended up collaborating with Claire. See how I did this? Little circle.
Yes.
Oh. I've been doing this long enough now. No, but it is the way that you and why you seem to appear on so many pieces of work, because you have such a big heart and the time to help others through this, that it's very endearing, and probably should thank you on behalf of everyone for all the time you have for everyone, because it is it's an amazing thing to see. So yeah, you deserve this. You deserve that very warm-hearted story.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely deserve.
Yeah. So yeah. let's talk about your two project. Who wants to start?
Yeah. Maybe you should, because you're the one who invited.
I did. So it's this project had been brewing in my brain, as these things do, sort of on the back burner for quite a while. So I've been studying experimental archaeology with regards to performance poetry, obviously getting a lot of inspiration from Terry Gunnell, Gisli Sigurdsson, that kind of scholar in Iceland. And one of the things I've been studying is the poem Völuspá, which, for those of you who don't know, is the first poem you will see in the Poetic Edda. It's the first manuscript page. It's a really, really interesting poem because it's written in the voice of a seeress, a völva, someone who is telling the future. And it's a cyclic poem about the creation of the world, the endeavors of the gods, Ragnarok, and then the rebirth of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's, in a very brief nutshell, there's so much debate about the poem because it's got no traceable author or composer in that sense. The common belief is that it is a work of collective authorship. It's something that's existed in oral literacy for a very long time, and no one knows exactly how long. And the manuscripts are all we've really got as clues. It appears in two main manuscripts. That's the Codex Regius and Hauksbok. And they're very slightly different versions, but far more similar than different, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Which gives you, I mean, what I've been studying is the fact that there was clearly some kind of archetypal poem which existed in the mind before it existed on paper. And people had an idea of what they were taking down and what it was even before it. So there was never really a moment of composition, just moments of variation, I think. Okay. And Snorri talks about it too. He quotes it at length in the Prose Edda. And the idea is his work or his manuscript predates a lot of the manuscript copies we have of Völuspá itself. Mm-hmm. So clearly he was talking about something which was A, well known, because he says, as it says in Völuspá. So people clearly knew what he meant by Völuspá, much mm-hmm. as we would know. I'm trying to think of a really well-known poem which would be the equivalent, but possibly a nursery rhyme is the closest thing I can come to. So okay. like, you'd know, if I said to you, Pop Goes the Weasel, or Hickory Dickory Dock, or mm-hmm. Humpty Dumpty, you'd know exactly what I meant, mm-hmm. even if you couldn't remember all the words. And I think Völuspá is a more serious version of that. So,
I mean, Humpty Dumpty is pretty serious.
It is pretty serious.
He has a big fall.
He can't be put together again, which is very sad.
It's a serious accident.
And one might say, I never thought I'd compare Ragnarok to Humpty Dumpty, if I'm honest.
You heard it here first.
It's falling apart, except in this case, the world is put back, or it's rebirthed in a more pure form. So it's essentially, what's really interesting about this poem is the speaker. She commands immediate attention. Her first words are, Kljóðs byðak atlar helga kind, I give me a hearing, holy kindred. And it's the idea is she's having a vision. So there's all sorts of debate about the importance of women or the relative power of women in the Old Norse world. And this poem seems to point to a clue that, you know, there was some idea or deep archetype of a powerful woman who commanded great attention and respect. Mm-hmm. And such that people like Snorri were quoting her as a persona for years to come afterwards. And I was just, the poem really spoke to me because it's such a compelling voice. And as I'm studying it on an academic level and studying the kind of ins and outs of what might have been possible in a performance context, or what might the mind poem have looked like as opposed to what was on paper, what would have caused them to write it down, and under what circumstances that might have happened. I thought, well, let's actually do an experiment and do it yourself. See what happens. You know, this is essentially an adaptation I've done. I've not, say, copied a translation word for word. But within that, I'm also exploring the boundaries of where the mind poem could have varied while still essentially remaining itself, mm-hmm. how far you can vary it, what kind of conditions might have come into the retelling, like, say, props, not costume so much, but how might you alter your voice? How might you have brought this story across? Mm-hmm. And so I wrote my own version, and I thought, we've got this amazing event in Oxford coming up called the Old Norse Poetry and Performance Conference, which I'm helping to organize. Okay. And while I'm not giving a paper, I decided, all right, well, we've got some performances in the evening. So I thought, let's have some fun. I'm going to take this poem out and make a dramatic performance of it. And I thought, well, how do I work as a performer? And what I really respond to is music. And there's no small chance that music might have been used in some way to help tell the story. Mm-hmm. Whether always or just sometimes, depending on who did it, is the question. But I'd already seen Kjell perform at Midgardsblot, and I just instinctively knew he was a storyteller from the way he did Blota. Mm-hmm. And I didn't exactly think, there's my guy, while I was standing on the floor watching him, but the idea was sort of back of here somewhere. And then later on, I was with Rune Rasmussen at a conference, and he said they'd worked together on Raven Banner. And I said, oh, I'm so jealous. I really love his music. I've been thinking about contacting him myself. And Rune, of course, being a legend, said, oh, I'll send a message. And so we started talking. What happened next? I can't really remember. How did we get to this point?
You kind of explained what you were thinking, and I absolutely love the idea of trying to do this. And for my part, you know, I've been doing so much like big productions with bands and blah, blah, blah for so many years. I really wanted to go back into something, you know, more intimate, you know, mm-hmm. Less gigantic, and and then Claire came along and you want to join me do this project?
Is that an imitation of my voice?
I think it was. I mean, it's not far
cheers.
Off.
Cheers, buddy.
So, is this going to be a one-time performance? Can I come and watch? That's what I'm getting at.
You can come and watch if you sign up to the conference. I think registration is still open, and we can put the link somewhere for anyone who's interested in attending virtually, although that'll be papers and not performance. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Jen and I would say we've been discussing where we can go with this potentially, and I think there's no complete answer yet, but the idea is we might perform it again or try to record it properly. The main thing is just focusing on this next live performance as sort of a test run or a premiere and seeing what comes out of it, I guess.
So will you be performing together? It's not, you're just not making like a soundtrack and then you're going to hit play.
Oh, no, no. This is interaction. Yes, this is definitely, we're doing this together.
yeah, because it means the whole point. I wanted to work with Kjell because he, you know, I could see that he's good at multitasking with different instruments and performances I've done in the past with live poetry reading. It's sort of like you're not playing to a set music. You're sort, and you're not doing it completely ad lib either. You're sort of forming a dual performance by watching each other, mm-hmm. And so Kjell has these amazing layers and these amazing reverb effects. And if he can see I'm moving into a different section, because the poem's, it's got four or five clear different mood sections. Mm. And we've basically been playing with just what, we just literally have to keep our eyes on what the other one's doing, allow some space. And I mean, I knew nothing about the reverb effects, the technology, the kind of buttons that had to be pressed. So this was why Kjell suggested I come and spend some time in the workshop and we actually thrash it out before we have to do it before a live audience.
I mean, that does make sense.
I'm so glad you did. We had to work out a few things, didn't we?
Yeah, but there's always a few things. We would have pulled it off, but, you know, it's always a good thing to be a little bit prepared.
Yeah.
I guess it's always good to have a little run through. So were you planning on just, unless Sherlock have said that, were you planning on just having him come over and just figure it out in the moment?
Not quite. I wasn't sure what I was suggesting. I mean, when I wrote to him first, we were just having a discussion.
Yeah.
And I was seeing what was possible. So I asked him, what do you think's possible? And at some point during the discussion, he said it would be really good if we could meet up prior to the performance. And I said, absolutely agree. Let me try. And I was coming back from Iceland from another conference. And I thought, well, that's a really good opportunity to hop back via Norway and just spend a couple of days, see what happens. Mm-hmm. It was really productive. We got an awful lot done.
Good.
Yeah, we did.
Good, good. How do you even start to put music to that, I guess, Cheryl? Where do you begin? And because something, especially something so Because it is a very powerful, powerful poem. It talks about the creation and the end of the world, effectively.
Yeah.
What's bigger than that, apart from Humpty Dumpty?
Yeah. Probably. Now, for me, it's I've been doing quite much soundscaping and sound design. It's just that people don't see it because it's not done by my name. It's done for other projects. And it's not so easy to see, but then if you go really back in time to the early 90s, I was doing a lot of gigs just with my guitar and a lot of tonno effects and making this huge soundscapey kind of things. And it hit me quite early in the process of talking with Claire about this, that, I think this is when I'm actually going to reintroduce this into my life, which I've been missing a lot since I went all acoustic, because this time you'll see me do something completely different from what you've been seeing me doing the last few years. Mm-hmm. So I think the visual of what to do came to me quite early. So I invested in some, because all my equipment has been gone a long time ago. So I invested in a new box last year that can do everything, as Claire knows by now.
It's a magic box. It's amazing to watch it go. It's literally that big, and it's amazing stuff comes out of it.
I mean, what's this box we're talking about? What does it do?
If you've seen all these guitar players, they have all these boxes on stage, and each box they press with their foot can make a different kind of sound.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
No, if you see the rock bands and stuff, the guitar players are always stepping around on the floor, changing sounds with his foot on boxes and stuff. And so this company called Headrush, they just reinvented the whole scene, and they created this one box with a few buttons on it. And then you can just, with a big touch screen, you can just add the boxes you want inside the box. So you have one box that you can do pretty much absolutely anything.
Okay, box it. But when you say anything, I'm lost. So when you say you can do anything, it's like you have the sound of an instrument going into it, and then you can manipulate that within the magic box.
Yeah. So for this project, I'm mainly going to use my Kravik lyre and my Mura harpa, and they'll not sound like Mura harpa and Kravik lyre.
Okay.
There's a lot of reverb and looping is the essentially very useful part.
So I can make like a big bassy drone and just loop it so it continues to play while I can do other things on top of that. And, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know the little machine now. I think I first ever saw the Reggie Watts, the comedian, using one of those. I don't know if either of you know who Reggie Watts is, but he does a bunch of a lot of it, I think, is with his voice. And then just loops it back in and keeps looping on top of it and creates these really insane little songs.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds fun. It's like, it's sort of something, I think Bill Bailey has done it inevitably at some point. Mm-hmm. And I really like his shows as well.
Yeah. I feel like Ed Sheeran did it as well. I don't know why that one sticks.
Yeah, he started doing that. Yeah.
He probably stole it.
Yeah,
allegedly.
He started his career from that,
Yeah, that was it. I think he started on the underground, was it, and using a loop. Exactly. Ooh, I don't want to upset Ed. How do you? What problems, I guess, have you come up in telling a story like this in a poem and trying to, because obviously, like you say, we have it written down.
Yeah.
But now you've got to almost try and take it back to its original form or what you feel like is original form. So you kind of.
Yeah. You say original. I mean, original is a tricky word because it suggests a poem. We can't guarantee that. And in fact, it seems unlikely. It seems more a case of slow conglomeration, which became a definite shape. I call it it's a bit of a weird term. I've been calling it the archetypal self or enclosure of the poem. So the boundaries within which it exists, the content it probably had that was consistent. And I've been trying to work out the areas it might vary a bit more. So for example, if you can use a sort of mixture of modern performance data and medieval textual study to work out some of the Venn diagram of, okay, where does it stay the same? Where might it have varied according to different performers? Because every performer brings something different. So this is why reception studies are so interesting, because at some point you're sort of joining this continuum of people who have made their own thing out of a work. And just because they've made their own thing doesn't mean it's different to the work. It's part of the chain, in a sense. So there's, if you look at Codex Regis and Hauk's book, and this isn't even without considering Snorri's quotations, this is just the two kind of the two long copies we have, which are not quotations, you notice that most of the content is almost exactly the same, except some changed vowel sounds and spellings, but that's probably more likely due to age or scribalship. And the beginning section and the end sections are pretty much set, except one big difference in Hauk's book, which seems to point to a Christian reading of the poem and talks about a savior coming after the rebirth of the world, who's a sort of more, it's a sort of post-Odin, omnipotent, godly figure who seems to point to the Christian God. But apart from that, beginning and ending are, if not set in stone, very, very similar. And it's the middle sections which talk about non-sequential stuff up to Ragnarok. So various details of the world of the gods, various small events like, and, you know, characters who contribute to the building of the world and its destruction. And that bit's not so much a chain. It's more mixed up between the two versions. So one version might have certain stanzas in a certain order. The other one has them in a slightly different order, but all the content is there, which got me to thinking that from a performance perspective, that's not too unusual, because you get a lot of people who remember the exact beginning of a poem and the exact end, because those are the striking bits that people most frequently come back to or remember. And then the middle of it, because there's no clear chain, it's all just sort of little steps building up to Ragnarok, and you can do them in different orders. I imagine, just pure out of my own senses, spidey senses here, and I don't know how academic this is, that an individual performer could have taken those sections in the order they preferred, or just tried to take as much from memory as possible. But if they'd varied what they'd heard a little, it wouldn't matter, provided they got to certain stepping places at certain points and the overall shape of the poem didn't change.
Yeah.
And that's storytelling, because you can do, there are various things you can rest on, like little refrains and things. And there are lots of those in Völuspá. There's two or three main refrains. And my idea is that possibly these were almost like sitting places, because if your performer's thinking, oh, fuck, what verse is next? You can just go back to that refrain while you think in your back brain about what's coming. And you don't really have to think about the refrain. And that's quite a good way of saving yourself a gap. So really the problem, it's not so much a problem, it's more just trying to keep a balance between looking at what the texts seem to suggest, putting your own variations in, or not variations, just your own little colloquialisms and things that help you perform it well, because obviously you want to be the best, you want to do your best telling, and that's really depends on who you are. And where the music came in is that as a poem, it's really awkward to do in full without some kind of accompaniment or help, because it's so intense.
Okay.
And you're at risk of being on a plateau of intensity or building up to a big climax point. And then, but it's all fairly grim stuff or fairly intense and mystical stuff. There's very few relaxing bits. And so you're kind of at risk of boring your audience through sheer intensity.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So what really helps is for you to be able to use the music as a sort of floater. You're riding off the back of it, allowing it to carry you forward. And if you stop, that's, you know, the musician can have a play, do a few refrains, play with some effects, and then you start again. And it just makes it the whole experience. A, it's more intense for the audience and more interesting for them. And B, it gives you a breather, because you're not sustaining the intensity all by yourself. You're just free to relax and enjoy.
Yeah.
It's a pretty sense. Long and intense story to tell.
Yeah. It's about every rendition we did got to about 35 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And exactly. I knew it was long, but I wasn't...
It's long.
Yeah, 35 minutes.
But that's without the breaks, you know?
That's without the breaks.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, it's
you really put yourself into this then.
Yeah,
you've committed. It's a long poem.
It's a long poem, but it's so beautiful and so extraordinary that you don't feel... It's almost like what I imagine a trip must be like. So you start, you know, we'd start a recording and then I'd sort of brace myself like, okay, this is it. Once you're in it, that's half an hour. So yeah. You wouldn't just be able to casually start or stop at certain places. You'd have to do the whole chain.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean the pair of us on chairs, just eyeballing from time to time, sometimes going into ourselves, all the while very aware of this whole process going on. It was, and it was a bit of an out of body experience because essentially the poem means you have to become this person, but you have to see what she sees. Sometimes she speaks in the present, like she's seeing it happen right here.
Mm-hmm. So do you find yourself becoming the seeress?
Well, whatever everybody becomes her who recites the poem. That's the beauty of it.
Okay. Well, yeah.
But it's intense because you are talking about some fairly... The way I read her, she always asks Odin, do you want more and what? And the idea is he's asked her to recite her lore for the audience. It's his bid, and they're sort of not a power struggle exactly. So she's got special knowledge. It's not that he necessarily hasn't got it, but he wants her to give it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like she's giving... The thing is that the knowledge is... It's sort of already known in a way, and it's just him asking her to recite to make sure. And what you're reciting is the end of the world. You're telling people what's going to happen, what has happened, what is happening right now. And it's, I imagine for any person, if you think of it as a typical shamanic trance or the idea of a spirit speaking through a body, because we're not sure what that is, whether she's meant to be speaking from the point of view of a spirit is speaking through her, or she's speaking and she's just old as the hills, whatever it is, it's got to be an exhausting experience. Mm-hmm. The apocalypse is pouring out of your mouth and you have to relive it again and again and again. And so there's this sense of awesome power. There's a sense of storytelling skill, but also fatigue, because at the end of the vision, she literally sinks. And this is in many ways a reflection of, you know, I imagine you've talked before about the habit of the practice of sitting at crossroads, asking for knowledge. The god visits you with knowledge. Often with readings, someone would be sitting on a raised platform, and then the descent is a sign that they're coming back to the real world. Mm-hmm. So she's literally off and away for that whole thing, and then she sinks. And I always read that as slight, you know, you're probably exhausted by the end.
I imagine so, yeah. I feel like you'll be exhausted after...
Jill and I were exhausted.
It was rather intense.
What was it like for you? Because I think I'd just go to another place while it was happening. What was it like for you sitting there playing with things and picking things up and putting them down again?
First off, it's you know, sometimes it gets hard to focus because you're so good at what you're doing. So you kind of drags me into the story.
That's a good start.
Yeah, her voice, it's just mesmerizing. It just takes you, you know, in there. So, for me at that state or the state we're still at, for me, it's about, you know, What sounds can I use to push this forward or to help Claire tell this story, you know, and then a little bit back and forth what she thinks, and you know, and try to paint these pictures around it. So there's a lot of composing going on at the moment, but then you know the thing is then after, and I think the composition is about to get set. I know some things that you don't at the moment, Claire.
Well, I hope so. Lovely surprise.
Yeah. But then, you know, it comes to the part when I can start to rehearse, because you've been rehearsing and learning this for some time, and now I can start rehearsing and learning my parts. And yeah. then it comes to the part where we both can just go in there, you know, together and be there and do this.
Yeah. And we might be faced by, we're already having some debates with the venue about technology. So that's the next hurdle.
Yeah. But
cross that bridge when we come. But yeah, the whole project really started off after I'd recovered from my flight. You'd printed the poem I sent you off. We basically mm-hmm. ended up, because the studio is such a busy place and there's stuff on every tape, we ended up, I think, on the floor with our copies, just writing things on the paper and saying, what do you think goes here?
Yeah.
And Joe would say things like, oh, I think the Kral harp would fit there and I would have to pick up something else at this point. Where should I pick it up? Where should I stay quiet? Mm-hmm. And it was as simple as that. Just we had to hack it out bit by bit.
Yeah.
So somebody like me who is not musically minded at all. I'm just not. It's as simple as that. If I wouldn't know where to start. If you turned up to me and was like, I've got this poem, I need some music for it. As ridiculous as that sounds, I just wouldn't even. I mean, I'd get the little triangle out and just give it a little tap and be like, I can probably do this, but I wouldn't even know where to even begin to put music to something, especially not something as intense as this. And that's how do you start with that, Jill? Like, what is the point that you're like, I don't know. But for somebody like me, it's just so far out of my head, this idea of just being like, I'm going to create music for this.
For me, it starts at one certain point, and I tend to find myself at that point more and more often. It's at a point where, you know, you need to decide, should we do this the authentic way, or should we do this, you know, should we have some more fun, mm-hmm. you know? Because, of course, I can try to do it completely acoustic and very authentic, but it would easily get a bit boring. So I was very happy when I was allowed to muck about with the effects and paint
your magic box
soundscapes.
Out.
Yes.
I wanted you to muck about.
Because then I can paint this huge, you know. When I use my, I mean, for a lot of this story, you know, I'm just playing this one tone, and then I add textures to that one tone to make it interesting, you know, for two reasons. One, to make it, to try to help Claire make it suck you into the story, you know, make it like this kind of lack of words again. the suggressive kind mm-hmm. of thing, you know. And then the second part is that I cannot take too much space, because we need, you know, the most important part of this is that everybody needs to hear the voice, you know, so yeah. I can't just add a lot of symbols and, you know, because mm-hmm. that would be horrible. So I need to find this warm kind of tones that goes underneath and in the background and, you know, paints around the voice yeah. to make this room for Claire.
That's what I was thinking. You have to try and not be too overpowering and steal the limelight as well, which just has to be that kind of that balance between having music there but having it there subtly enough that it complements but doesn't yeah. overpower. That must be,
and that's the main difference between playing with music and with storytelling, because with music, you know, when you go to the refrain and you know, when the singer starts screaming, you can just go for it, you know, and everybody's going to hear him anyways. But that wouldn't work with a story like this.
No.
You know, so I need to find ways to make it more powerful without taking more space, kind of, you know. And that's when all this kind of bassy, a little bit muffled sounds comes in, and I'm doing some pretty, you know, some of those Viking music communities out there will probably, you know, run after me with a rope, you know.
They run after me as well, though, to be fair. You know, it's this kind of project is not, despite the fact that, you know, authenticity is a hugely big word to try to cram into a small space, they still try. Mm-hmm. And really, what I think when it comes to medieval projects or, you know, medievalism, it's if you consider the average, well, if there is such thing as an average, any medieval setting, a storyteller would have made use of their environment and their means to tell the story. And that's all we're doing. Jell has all this wonderful equipment at his fingertips, so why not use it? And it's mm-hmm. not, the purpose is the same, regardless of how we do it. And he does, aside from the fact that, you know, it is a very different kind of musical production from, say, big band stuff, the nature of the project allows him also to take little asides, to show off his instruments. Some, I will stop speaking and then I'll look at him and he'll do a little run on his Kralhopper. Or there's a brilliant bit where I'm addressing Odin directly and I'm a little bit pissed off with him as the series. So I'm like, I sat outside and you came and you blinded me with these bits. Why are you bothering me, old man? And he comes in very nicely with this lovely sung motif and not exactly the voice of Odin, but it sounds almost like Odin replying and it's super creepy and wonderful. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds wonderful. Yeah. I think people get too caught up in the whole authenticity thing. It has its time and its moments and its place, but that doesn't mean that you can't also have fun with these things and try something, and it doesn't value it any less. But some people are just like that, aren't they? As soon as it's not authentic, they're like, oh, I'm not dismissed but, that. But, it doesn't count anymore, and it's ridiculous. You're missing out on so much fun and so many really cool projects.
And then
what
is authenticity? You know, you have the authenticity where you can try to be, you know, living 1,000 years ago, which is not very authentic to the people living today. Mm-hmm. Or you could take this because we are living now. My calendar says 2023, mm-hmm. you know, and what would be authentic today? I mean, today people are using effect pedals. They are using, you know, this is today, you know, and I've been teaching about authentic Viking music for decades now, but you know, and yeah, I do appreciate that stuff, but you know, let's just face it, you know, we're not locked up to pretend we're living 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. No, we're not. And when you look at medieval literature, there is no, you know, original medieval literature either, really. It's a constant rehash and plagiarism of material that's already gone by authors and scribes who wanted to put their own spin on someone else's material. You know, it's before the printing press, it's almost plagiarism in itself was a good thing because it showed that you were adopting someone else's great content and making it your own. And that was perfectly acceptable, but you could do it with your own spin or nest it within another story or a different dialect, and that would be fine. And that is, you know, that's when you study medieval stuff, that's what you come to realize. There's no, it is itself a conglomerate and often is itself a capturing of a past that people didn't, because this is happening over hundreds of years. You get literature which is a recapturing of something done a couple of hundred years earlier. And the person inscribing the document clearly didn't know everything about that time. Mm-hmm. But has chosen to adapt that content for their own, to be relevant for their own. So we're just doing an extension of that. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. Someone did actually ask a really good question in the chat that I'd like to bring in now, which is the language. Okay. We're doing it in English with occasional bites of the Old Norse text for the reason that what I wanted to capture about this performance was the atmosphere, the voice, the aspect of receiving directly. You've got some people like W.H. Auden who will do their translations in English, but without a gloss for the heavy allusions and the heavy metaphors, because their argument is, oh, well, an Old Norse audience wouldn't have needed to ask for explanations. And that, yeah, but you're performing this to a modern audience who do. Mm-hmm. And because it's, you know, it will always be a translated experience. So to some extent, you have to make a decision between so-called representing the whole as we would see it without a gloss, or do we want to recreate the experience of the audience in receiving it to the heart straight without the need of explanation? And I'm always a fan of communication over lack of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's in English. But obviously, if this project grows, there's also room to do a full Old Norse version and see how that compares.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think. But how, if you did a full Old Norse version, I feel like it would be fantastic for
The sound, you mean?
5 minutes.
Mm.
And then everybody who only speaks English and has no idea what you're saying would be like,
Yeah.
this sounds amazing. But after 5 minutes, it's like, but I really want to know what you're actually saying now. And
There
that's
you are.
what would happen.
Exactly. Only an Icelandic audience would really stand some chance of sitting through the full 35 minutes. And even then.
I do think that more people would actually appreciate it. I mean, I've been working a lot with like world music and like traditional music from around the world, you know. And there are quite many people out there that appreciate just, you know, because they can feel the story somewhat without words. And
Okay, yeah.
I think that and the way you use those words and the way you perform them, I think that people would actually appreciate it.
It's an experiment at some point that maybe we should do. I would need to either memorize the full poem in Old Norse or cheat and read it. My friend Kauri, who you've had on, can actually do the whole thing in Old Norse. He's amazing. We even did an experiment. I was trying to work out whether my take on medieval performance was likely to be correct according to modern data. I said, well, do you ever forget bits of the poem? And if you find yourself forgetting bits, where does it come? And so he was like, right, I'm going to get the book and we're going to see what happens. And he deviated from the order of the Codex Regius somewhere in the middle, where I figured that the deviation would be more likely. So it's not exactly, it doesn't necessarily re represent a common truth, but I think it's a very encouraging finding in that sense.
Yeah, it would be. Now I think about it more, I feel like it would be more more entertaining than maybe. I don't know, I can't decide. I feel like if I was listening to it with headphones on at home, maybe then I wouldn't mind it being in a different language that I don't understand. Because I listen to like Rammstein are one of my favorite bands. I have not a fucking clue what they're saying, but I just enjoy the music, and you get a feel from it. And same with Kappa, the Norwegian rap type. So what do you class as rap, I guess. Like them, I love their music. I pick up like the odd words, but you get a feel from it. And they're a very political band, but you get a feel from the message through the music. But if I was watching it live, I don't know if I would get. I don't know. I can't make my mind up. I feel like if I was watching it live, I would want to understand.
But people are going to operas, you know?
Yeah, they are. And with operas, often what happens is people provide. I think one of the things you could consider in terms of putting this out there is, would it be possible to do with subtitles or with people get brochures with the poem in it in English? I think that's perfectly possible.
And they
I
could
do agree that
try
it's
and.
quite, it's quite dense, and I wouldn't. Yeah, I would absolutely consider recording the whole thing in Old Norse or say in just, but I always believe in allowing a toehold. And as Chair says, people listen to operas quite happily, and part of what allows them to do that is we now have the wherewithal to provide the lyrics or quite easily in another language, and you just soak in the performance, and you can maybe check it occasionally or you can read it before you go, and then you have an idea of what's going to happen.
Do you think that if you did record it, then it would kind of lose its magic of because at the minute when you if you perform it, it's likely going to be different every time, and it is very that more natural storytelling version. But then as soon as you record it, I guess it becomes a finite version. And then does it lose that beauty to it? Maybe I don't know.
It's definitely a different kind of medium, and it's a different kind of working with things. And you can do a lot of things, you know, in the studio that's hard to do live, especially for a project like this. I mean, if we were like many bands using click tracks and backing tracks, you know, but then you don't have the ability to, you know, go for that, or, you know, then you need to stick to, you know. So I I think it would be really interesting to see what we can make of it in a studio. I do not think that that would ruin the possibility of doing it live later, because it's a different thing.
Yeah, it's the project, if it does take shape as it looks like it's going to, I think would be a combination of recorded output and performance output. And I mean, this is very useful just purely from a study point of view, because part of my interest is in finding out what would change the dynamics of performance and what would having it set do. I mean, you could see it as manuscripts are essentially the earliest version of recording studio possible, because that's a flat version that someone has received, however they've received it.
That's so what I was thinking.
It's a fascinating parallel in that. And you need, but you need, the irony, of course, is we need the manuscripts, because while they are sort of, it's a bit like dinosaur footprints, they're not the living thing. They are symbols of the living thing that have that are signifiers of what's been going on. But without them, we couldn't begin to study it in quite the same way. So it's a sort of funny symbiotic relationship. And you can't rely completely on one, but you can't rely completely on the unknowns either. So you have to sort of draw this interesting Venn diagram. And you can bring in performance technology to do that, and live performance where everything is, who knows what the F is happening. We'll just go into this and see what happens, especially if the audience are disruptive or something cries or a dog barks or there's a shitty microphone. You never know.
Yeah, no. You got to work your way around it. It is interesting, because I think a lot of people particularly people that are interested in this stuff on a basic interest level, without, you know, like,
yeah,
like for Viking bro-y type people, like you, or the people who complain about authenticity and that kind of, there are two written down versions of this, the most popular being the Codex Regis? How do you pronounce it?
Codex Regis, I pronounce Regis. Other people do it differently.
Yeah. So obviously the most famous one that is I think people fail to remember that's just one snapshot that has been written down, or one version that's written down. And like you said, there will be of however many other versions to have got it to this point, but also probably living at the same time as this one was written down, and they might, like you said, the beginning and the end are probably the same, but there's all these variations in the middle. But people, just because there is this one version or two versions that are written down, they go, yeah, but if you swear, that's not this, if you don't do it exactly like that, that's not, you're not doing it right, it's wrong. And they forget that it was a living poem that would have been told different by this. Not even only told differently by different people, but the same person telling the story will have told it different every time. I have stories I tell my friends from my childhood, and they're fucking different every time I tell them. I add a little bit in to make it a little bit more fun.
Of course, but the essential shape is the same.
Yes, right? Exactly.
It's the question of the paradox of consistency and fluctuating detail. Where do we draw that boundary? What's likely to have been consistent, and where are we more likely to vary it depending on different storytellers? And that depends on something that Stephen Mitchell calls the ethnography of performance. So what does it mean to communicate well in a certain era, and what sort of factors would have come into the communication side beyond what people saw as the poem before it, you know, before it's put down? Mm-hmm. So what happens with that? So it's exactly like anecdotes in a way. You keep the same shape, but different bits can change. And what bits change depends on what's important. Essentially, the shape, I think, is what's generally consistent.
Perfect. Wonderful. We're just over an hour. Let's wrap this up. And we can do a little Q&A with the people watching. After, I know, obviously, you are both welcome back. Once you've done this, once it's out there and you've done it, we can talk about what you learned and what you thought and how it went. It's a fascinating project. I'm glad you're doing it. It's a lot of fun, and I would love to come and watch it if I can. I think it will be be amazing. You look like you make a good team. Just sat here seeing the smiles on both of your faces as you're talking about this process means that it's a very special, magical thing. And when people have fun creating things, that's when you get the best out of it. That's when you get the best results. So yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. I'm very grateful to Chell for being such a good sport and just really meeting this project with open arms. Like, he's incredibly generous with his time, as you say, and I really couldn't have got it to this level without him. So it's I feel very lucky.
I feel quite lucky to be invited into this. So it goes both ways, you know. I really enjoy working with it. Yeah, of course.
All the love. Yeah, it's lovely to see. It's what I want on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay. Chell, where can people listen to you, find you, listen to your music, support you?
My music is available pretty much anywhere. If you want to support me, please head over to my Bandcamp where you can add and buy a few CDs, a couple of nice t-shirts like the one you're both wearing.
Yes.
Yeah, or at least this one's there. I don't think that one's there at the moment, but I'll add it back soon.
Yes, dude, this one is lovely. I love this t-shirt.
And if you like it, you can find that on my webshop at kjellbrotten.com then.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah. Claire, where can people find you?
I don't have cool merch. You can find me at Clarify on Instagram or at Claire_poet on Twitter. And hopefully, if you want to hear about the Old Norse Poetry and Performance Conference 2023, just Google it. We've got a website. Please do sign up if you'd like to come along. And I have yet to buy a t-shirt, but I really feel that's something I should do sometime. And seeing as I'm the odd one out at this party.
No, we both turned up with our Chell Bretton merch.
Hilarious.
I'm the uncool one in the room.
No, never, never. But yeah, everyone, if you can make it, let's all get there and support people that come on the podcast. I would, like I say, I'm going to do my best to come down and we can have a little podcast hangout.
Nice.
It would be lovely, yeah.
Yay.
What was Kim asked if you could mention the link again.
I certainly can. Just, it's, that's really unprofessional. I can't remember the web address off the top of my head, but if you Google, would you like me to put it in the chat?
Yes.
Yes, I'll put the name of the conference and then you can Google it.
We will just put it in the show notes. So anybody listening to this,
in the show notes.
If you know what the show notes are, if you don't know the show notes, it's a little description bit that comes below the podcast, wherever you're listening to it. And we'll put the link in there and you can just click on it and then you can come and join and you can come hang out with me and the lovely Claire and Chell. And we'll.
Or you can just come online and see the papers and enjoy yourself from wherever you happen to be. That's all right as well.
No, come in person. More fun. No, you can watch them. You can do it online as well. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating, a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen to the Q&A that we're going to do right after this on Patreon. And you also get the story time episodes and a bunch of other stuff. You get the whole back catalog you can listen to. And that's from £3 a month. And it helps keep the lights on. Yay. perfect. Thank you both very much. And yeah, let's ask some questions.